Gertrude Eileen Trevelyan is the greatest English novelist of the 20th century that no one has ever heard of. Nearly 80 years after her death, her work is finally beginning to be rediscovered. But her life offers a cautionary tale for any writer who wants his or her work to be remembered. For decades, my hobby has been exploring the work of long-forgotten writers. Since 2006, I've been writing about them on my Neglected Books website. I first came across Gertrude Trevelyan's name when I read her novel, Appius and Virginia, in 2018. I was so impressed by the quality of Trevelyan's writing and by the extent to which she had become utterly forgotten that I searched out the rest of her books. It wasn't easy or cheap to find them. In some cases, there are fewer than a dozen copies to be found anywhere in the world, and these only available in archives like the British Library. In the course of discovering Trevelyan's work, I found myself digging into the facts about her life as well. Unlike someone like Virginia Woolf or Sylvia Plath, who left behind thousands of pages of notebooks, diaries, letters, and manuscripts, and who were part of a large network of writers and artists of their time, Gertrude Eileen Trevelyan left behind almost no trace aside from her books. She was born in Bath on the 17th of October, 1903, the first and only surviving child of Edward and Eleanor Trevelyan. Gertrude's father had inherited a modest fortune, which enabled him to live a life of quiet leisure, writing, gardening, belonging to fraternal organizations. Gertrude grew up in a small, comfortable, and conventional family. She attended Princess Helena College in London as a day student. She went on to attend Lady Margaret Hall, then one of the few women's colleges in Oxford. There she began to cultivate what she called her taste for misanthropic reflection. As she later wrote, while at Oxford, she maintained without effort a position of total obscurity, academic as well as social. In June 1927, however, this slight, quiet, and antisocial undergraduate made international headlines when she became the first woman chosen for the Newdigate Prize, a prize given each year for the best poem written by an Oxford student on a set topic. The novelty of the award far outweighed the merits of her poem, Julia, Daughter of Claudius. The story was published in English-speaking papers around the world, from Adelaide, Australia, to Walla Walla, Washington. The actual presentation of her award, however, was eclipsed, literally. For the first time in its history, Oxford's annual awards ceremony, the Encenia, was delayed one day to allow students and faculty to witness the first solar eclipse visible from England in over a century. When the ceremony was held the following day, most of the male students and a good number of the faculty members were absent. The women students at Oxford, however, were there in force to cheer on their fellow student. After leaving Oxford, Trevelyan moved to London. In 1931, she took a flat at number 107 Lansdowne Road in Notting Hill. And there, aside from her books, her story effectively comes to an end. She had precisely the prerequisites Virginia Woolf had called for in a room of one's own: talent, £500 a year, and a room of her own. With these, in the space of 8 years, she wrote 8 novels of striking originality and stylistic invention. Her first novel, Appius and Virginia, was published in 1932. Its story was unlike anything that had ever been written by a woman novelist before. Appius and Virginia is the story of a bold and mad experiment. Virginia Hutton, a parson's daughter and university graduate in her 40s, purchases a secluded house in a small country village where she intends to put a theory to test. She purchases a orangutan she names Appius, takes him to her house, and there raises him in complete isolation, as if he were a human child. She dresses him as a boy, teaches him to eat with fork and spoon, tries to teach him the alphabet and how to read. Appius gradually learns how to mimic the behaviors that Virginia praises, but he remains fundamentally mystified by these exercises. For Virginia, this experiment is more than just a test. It is her effort to avoid becoming just another forgotten aging woman on the streets of London. All her willpower, all her suggestive force, was not too much to expend on this experiment, for if it succeeded, she would indeed have achieved something. She would have created a human being out of purely animal material and forced evolution to cover in a few years stages which unaided it would have taken eons to pass, and have proved not only the truth of the evolution theory, but the boundless possibilities of environment and early training. It must succeed. She knew, obscurely, inarticulately, that if this experiment failed, her existence would no longer be justified in her own sight. The newly awakened need of her being to create would be frustrated utterly. She would go back to Earl's Court and her bed-sitting room, gas fire and griller, separate meters, to her consumption of novels from the lending library, her bus rides to the confectioner's, her nightly sipping of conversation and coffee in the lounge, to middle age in a ladies' residential club. Each year a little older, a little stouter, or a little thinner, a little less quickly off the bus. Come along there, please. Come along. And the struggle with umbrella and parcels through the ranks of inside passengers, and the half-compassionate, half-contemptuous hand of the conductor, grimy and none too gentle, as she clambers down the swaying steps onto the sliding pavement. Each year, a little less bright in the after-dinner conversation, a little less able to remember the novels she has read, a little less able to find a listener, a little less able to live, and yet no more ready for death. For Trevelyan as well, Appius in Virginia was a bold experiment. In her case, it was an imaginative experiment, an attempt to apply the stream of consciousness technique to the thoughts of an animal mind. Here, for example, is how Appius perceives the sight of the moon from his bedroom window. He hissed derisively at the sinking fire and climbed onto Virginia's desk and thence onto the windowsill above it. Turning his back on the room, he found that he was standing up against a square of whiteness, very cold and very smooth. Very white, dull white, as high as himself as he stood there fingering the pane and splashing over onto a dark patch above him which had tiny yellow dots on it. Very cold. His thoughts had no words. Blackness. Big moving things. Big still things. Big black things. Stillness. Whiteness. Dazzle. When I first heard about Appius in Virginia, I assumed it was a comic novel, something along the lines of John Collier's 1930 novel, His Monkey Wife. Instead, it was something far more profound, for beneath the surface of this story about a woman trying to turn an ape into a human being, there was something deeply moving, a tragedy of two souls utterly incapable of understanding each other. The response of critics to Appius in Virginia set the pattern for how Trevelyan's subsequent work would be received. James Agate, perhaps the dean of British critics at the time, hated it. He found the story absurd and condemned the book as pretentious, puling twaddle. But others, like Gerald Gould, recognized just how bold Trevelyan's experiment was and how well she succeeded in realizing it.